Hi, welcome to today's Outdoor Explorers. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. Today we're talking about adventure and science. Over the course of humans' time on Earth, we've learned much from nature. In modern history, science and adventure have had a symbiotic relationship. Adventurers use science to justify their trips, and scientists take risks to collect data in extreme environments. On this show, I'll be talking to Dr. Carolyn Van Humer, who traveled from Bellingham to Kotzebue by rowboat, skis, pack raft, canoe, and on foot, and has just published a book about the trip titled The Compass is a Sun. On the second half of the show, I'll be talking to Dr. Kathy Kulitz, who has studied seabirds in Prince William Sound and the North Gulf of Alaska since 1978, a very relevant topic as we approach the 30th anniversary of the Exxon oil spill. When adventurers go out, many times they're observing and seeing and hearing things at a slower pace than we do when we're driving around town or around our home. So I'm really happy today to have someone on the studio for the first half that has gone the slow way through most of the state of Alaska in one fell swoop. Carolyn Van Humert and her husband Pat paddled or rode, I guess, skied, pack raft, hiked, more pack rafting, and canoed all the way from Bellingham, Washington to Kotzebue. So we're very excited to have Caroline on the show today. Welcome, Caroline.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to start at the end of the trip. You've now spent 6 months together, just primarily the two of you. You're looking at Kotzebue. And in my experience, when I finish long trips like this, even short trips, I just really want to have a hot shower. And what struck me about reading about your story and your trip is that you really weren't ready for it to end. And to me, that just tells me that there was something about this trip that was life-changing and really super significant in your life. So talk about that moment a little bit for me when you're at the end of this six-month, I don't know how many thousands of mile a trip, and you're looking at that hot shower and family and being home. How did that, I think that the culmination tells a lot about your trip. Like, why was it hard to leave? Why was it hard to end such a long trip?
I think one big difference from between this trip and other trips we had taken in the past was just, you know, the length of it was such that it had almost become a lifestyle as opposed to a blip in our ordinary lives. And so we'd been doing this, you know, day after day for, like you said, 6 months, and had really sort of embraced that way of being in the world. And we were, for the most part, pretty disconnected from regular communication. And it wasn't because we were trying to escape from, you know, friends or family or work commitments, but it was an opportunity, I guess, to sort of see the world in a different way. And I think that shift away from what we knew was, you know, a temporary lifestyle was one that was a little bit hard to wrap our heads around. And certainly we were excited to see friends and family. And don't get me wrong, you know, I can enjoy a hot shower like anyone else and some pizza and all those amenities of being in a community and in a home. But yeah, I think it was that transition away from a lifestyle and a time in our lives that was probably impossible to recreate, at least in that exact way. So those were a lot of the things that we were thinking about. It was, you know, sort of we'd met this goal that seemed nebulous for so many months. You know, Kotzebue was our destination, not because we were necessarily trying to get to Kotzebue itself, but it was where the route carried us, and it was kind of our logical endpoint. But you know, it was also bittersweet in that we were coming home, but we were also leaving what we had come to know, I guess, as a bit of our home, which was in the outdoors.
Great. So that's a bit of a teaser for the listeners. So let's go back. Now, you have written a book about this, correct?
That's right. Yeah. The book is forthcoming in just a couple of weeks. So yeah, I'll be doing a couple presentations in Anchorage. Would love to have people join me then. But the book is called The Sun is a Compass, and it's about the journey of the trip and also my own journey as a scientist and personally through these wildlands of Canada and Alaska.
And you are a research biologist with the USGS at Alaska Science Center here in Anchorage. And when you write in the book, you're having a moment in life. It sounds like you're having a moment like, what am I doing? Am I a scientist? Am I not a scientist? So you go on this really amazing trip, and sort of rediscover that passion. Correct?
Yeah, that's right. So just before taking this trip, I was finishing up a PhD in biology, and it was a project that I cared passionately about, but it was also one that had sort of forced me into the lab a lot more than I originally anticipated, and, you know, in the end, more than I wanted to be. I'm not really a lab person by nature. I can, you know, go through the rigors that I need to do things correctly, but in the end, I really love being out in the field, and that's what had drawn me to biology in the first place. And so I guess that I was having, as you said, a moment for sure, career-wise and otherwise, kind of wondering, you know, what is my direction and what's important to me? And this trip was an opportunity to, I guess, reconsider some of those possibilities and think deeply about what it meant to be a scientist and what parts of it I loved and maybe what I loved less. So that was part of my experience in being out in the wilderness.
Great. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about the trip. You started in Bellingham, correct?
Yeah, we started in Bellingham, and we took two rowboats up the coast of British Columbia and Alaska to our cabin, which is outside of Haines, Alaska, boat access. And one interesting thing about the Inside Passage was we were rowing these boats that, for one, Pat built, and for two, we had never actually rowed in any capacity prior to leaving on our trip. So there were a lot of new things to learn. Fortunately, the boats did work quite well, but it was a steep learning curve and figuring out how to operate them and all of their nuances. And as anyone who's familiar with rowing knows, you're facing backwards, so that's something else to get sort of used to. But that was the first leg of the journey. And then we took a little breather at our cabin and spent a few days there and kind of regrouped to ski and pack raft across the coast mountains and down into the Yukon territory, into Tagish Lake and then the headwaters of the Yukon River. And then we took advantage of the fact that it's easy to get a canoe between Whitehorse and Dawson, and so had a little kind of vacation on that stretch of the river, and then ended in Dawson, picked up pack rafts and all of our hiking gear and started making our way kind of north and east to the Wind River drainage and into eventually the Mackenzie Delta, which was in itself quite a challenge, which we can talk about later. Got to the Arctic coast and we're hiking and pack rafting west until Kaktovik, and then dropped down into the Brooks Range and essentially traversed a good portion of the Brooks Range and ended at the Noatak River, where we also did, we had our one air supply and canoed from there to Kotzebue.
That's amazing. About how many miles do you think?
It's about 4,000 miles in total.
Wow, that's like traveling from here to Chicago or the East Coast, something like that. That's by under your own power. That's super impressive. Congratulations.
Thanks. Go ahead.
When you started out, you said you had these boats that Pat built, which is impressive in itself, and maybe not necessarily a lot of experience rowing or out in the ocean, correct?
We had a lot of experience in the ocean, fortunately, but we didn't have much experience rowing. Of course, like, you know, all of these things, we had different intentions, but when we decided that we wanted to row, which was in large part so that we could use our legs along the way, so that when we went to start the other portions of the trip, we hadn't sort of been sitting with our legs atrophying for 6 or 8 weeks. But it turned out that getting expedition-style rowboats is really difficult, and so we came to the conclusion that if we wanted to row, Pat needed to build them, or one of us did, and Pat's the builder in our family, so that was the logical conclusion. And so he finished them, you know, just days before our trip, and they got shipped down to Washington and touched the water for the first time in Bellingham Bay, where we started our trip. So it wasn't our original plan, but it's how it worked out.
And what in that segment, we'll just sort of take this by segment, What were some of the highlights and possibly some of the lessons? Like if I were to say, hey, Caroline, I want to row from Bellingham to Haines, what advice would you give me? But you know, first, what were some of the highlights of that section of the trip?
Yeah, I think the highlights are easy for me as a bird biologist. It was an incredible time to be on the water. It's the peak of spring migration for many species. So there's just so much activity, birds constantly streaming overhead, all kinds of interesting species. Sea lions were really active. There's the herring spawn. So we had, you know, just amazing wildlife encounters along the way. Whales started to show up toward the northern end of the trip. So we were really lucky to feel like we were, you know, kind of experiencing the animals in their spring fever and in their migratory paths. And so that was a really neat opportunity. It was also a really quiet time to be on the Inside Passage, almost no other boats, and sort of had the place to ourselves.
And you started in March, correct?
That's right, yeah. And then I guess the downsides of rowing in March is that it's also a very stormy time. So we had, you know, some big storms that came through, hurricane force winds and, you know, pretty massive seas. So we ended up stuck on land for periods of time, sometimes for, you know, 3 or 4 days.
So that brings up a good question. During this trip, multiple times, some very serious, which we'll talk about a little later, you got stuck. I've been stuck in a tent a bunch with a couple other people. How did you not go stir crazy with anxiety and stress when you were just the two of you in this tent, trying to figure out, especially on the ocean, whether you should go or stay? How did you make those decisions?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess as far as the stir crazy goes, you know, at first it was really a nice break. Our bodies were feeling pretty worked from those long days and getting used to the act of rowing. So, you know, how it is when you're on a long, arduous trip, you welcome a rest day now and again. So initially it was kind of a treat to have a day off, but then if it stretched into multiple days, certainly we had all that anxiety associated with, you know, when do we go? What does this mean for our trip? We were pushing the seasons on both ends of the trip, so starting as early as we could in the spring, and then knew we'd be pushing against winter in the Arctic in September. So the longer we were stuck waiting, the farther away and the harder it seemed to reach our goal and to do all of the things that we wanted to do on the trip. So there was kind of that constant anxiety. And then, of course, your mind starts spinning on, you know, what else could I be doing right now? And having left behind a lot of things in our lives between, you know, graduate work and scientific research and family and lots of things happening, it's always hard to sort of be sitting and waiting and not go down that track. I guess from the standpoint of decision-making, you know, that's those gray areas that are really hard for trying to decide what's the right choice. And, you know, if the weather forecast is for a gale and huge seas, then it's easy to say, well, we have no choice but to stay put. It's when it's a small craft advisory and, you know, maybe we'd be fine, and kind of depends on which direction it goes once you get out there. Those were the days that were hardest to make a decision that we felt comfortable with. But the reality is, if you wait for perfect conditions, you'll never get anywhere. So there were certainly plenty of times where we had to kind of push out, check out the conditions, and then make a decision from there. I think also, you know, there's an element of intuition that factors into all of this. But in thinking about intuition, there's a difference between intuition and sort of our gut emotional reaction to a situation, which is usually, you know, natural human instinct is to do the easiest thing and the one that's least painful. And that usually means staying in your tent. But obviously, if you want to get from Bellingham to Kotzebue, that's not really an option on days that you can travel. So I think trying to sort of negotiate that gray area as best we could and thinking about it from an intuitive perspective, but also stepping back and as best we could trying to put together all the pieces and thinking, is this a situation if we get ourselves into, can we get out of it? And that's often one of the most critical pieces in moving forward is, you know, can you undo what you've done? And if not, and if the consequences are too high, then it might not be the right time to go. But, you know, if it's a situation that you can extricate yourself from somehow or another, then a lot of times we would at least give it a try and then back off if we had to.
Yeah, and were you? I'm impressed that the two of you did this and managed to survive as a couple, thrive. It sounds like as a couple. I know a lot of trips I've done. There's been three of us, so it sort of comes down to democracy a little bit. But with two people, I imagine that could be a lot more challenging to make those decisions.
Yeah, it can be, and I think you know, in entering into a trip with whether it's with two people or three people, I think there's sort of this pact or contract that you enter into. It has a certain level of trust, and you know, Pat and I certainly wasn't our first trip, so we'd had quite a lot of time to kind of hone that trust and our ability to make decisions together. But we don't approach decisions always, you know, from the same perspective, and so there's definitely a negotiation there with every major decision as to, you know, who do we listen to, and which of us has kind of the right instinct in this case. And you know, I think that that's where that level of trust comes in too, that you trust the other person not only to be competent, but to sort of help you through your high moments and low moments that inevitably appear when situations are challenging. And I guess as far as making, you know, explicit decisions, you know, I tend to be maybe a bit more emotional in my initial reaction to something, you know, that it's scary or it's hard and I'm not sure if I want to just withdraw and, you know, kind of bag it for that day. And I think Pat's approach tends to be one more of a sort of problem-solving approach. And I don't mean to say that I'm always the one to, you know, back off or say no, but, you know, we come at it from a different perspective, and we've learned that about each other over the years, that, you know, Pat will be rational, whether it's, you know, there's one moment in the book where I talk about our very first trip together a decade earlier, where we had gone into the headwaters of the Wind River and built a bark canoe. And we came across a dead horse, and this just kind of epitomizes Pat's maybe logical approach to everything. And we hadn't found any birch bark yet that we wanted to build the canoe. And there's this dead, bloated horse from the previous year's pack season. And Pat says, "Oh, well, why don't we build a skin boat?" And I just remember thinking, like, who is this lunatic? And why am I in the middle of the wilderness with him? You know, and he wasn't entirely right to be thinking, like, we should build a boat out of this horse hide. And maybe I wasn't entirely right to say, like, absolutely not, you're crazy. You know, so we kind of have to meet somewhere in the middle with those kinds of decisions. And I think there's also times where, you know, I've, for whatever reason, I've had this really strong intuition that the situation we're about to enter into is not the right one. And so, you know, I have Pat's trust enough that he knows if I say we're not doing this, then it's kind of called off for that moment. And you don't necessarily have to explain all of your reasons all of the time to know that it may or may not be the right thing to do at that moment. And the same goes for Pat. You know, there's times where I've felt perfectly fine in a situation and something has told him that, hey, there's some kind of danger out there and I think we need to back off. So I guess it's a strong element of trust. And we've also had the luxury of working together through situations like this enough to know each other pretty well.
Yeah, that's so important. And whether you're out in the middle of the wilderness or just dealing with stuff around the house. So this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock, on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking with Caroline Van Himmert, who has a book coming out titled The Sun is a Compass, where her and her husband, Pat, rode, hiked, and skied, and paddled all the way from Bellingham to Kotzebue. So you end up in Haines, and you have to leave the house. I mentioned that that was a little bit of a challenge to actually get motivated to keep moving. And then you climbed across the coastal ice fields and ended up, I guess, over in Whitehorse. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. So we took pack rafts across Lynn Canal, the body of water that separates our cabin from the east side of the canal, and then rolled up our rafts and put them on our backs and put our skis on our backs initially and started hiking up into the mountains. And it's actually the pass we were headed for is one we looked directly at from our cabin. So we knew where we were headed, that we just had a huge spring storm cycle that had come through and dumped, you know, feet and feet and feet of snow on the mountains. And so we were pretty apprehensive about the avalanche conditions. It had warmed up quite a lot and a lot of stuff had slid. So we were kind of counting on the fact that, you know, the system had, or the snowpack had flushed itself out. But, you know, as you know, whenever you're entering new terrain, snow is always a something of an unknown factor. And so that was a big consideration as we started making our way over. And we ended up actually having to change our route a bit and drop down lower and kind of get off of one glacier and get onto another to account for the somewhat unstable avalanche conditions. And that poses different challenges trying to get off of an ice field and onto another one. So yeah, it was a bit of a change of plans, but we eventually did make our way through and then came down the other side into Tagish Lake. And one challenge with a lot of what we were trying to do is that there just wasn't route information, because we were, you know, doing routes that either hadn't been done before or nobody had said anything about it, and we couldn't find any local knowledge about that area. So it's a lot of unknowns. And as we came off of the glacier into Tagish Lake, there was a river, Swanson River, that runs down, and you know, we were hoping we could pack raft some of it because the travel was extremely difficult. There wasn't much snow on the ground, and it was kind of situation where we're taking our skis off and putting them back on and trying to bushwhack through, you know, really rotten snow. But the river was running through a canyon, and it was pretty ice choked in places. And so when we finally did decide to give it a go, you know, we had a lot of apprehension about, is this going to work? And did a lot of scouting along the way, before we got into Tagish Lake and then eventually to the headwaters of the Yukon River and into Whitehorse.
So yeah, then you went from Whitehorse, and the logistics here, you were mailing food into these towns and villages, and either or probably supplementing stuff at the local stores. So then you got into Whitehorse, where your parents met you, right?
Yeah, they met us in Dawson, actually.
Oh, but Dawson.
Yeah,
okay.
Nearby
Dawson.
There. Yeah, yep. We were able to rent a canoe really easily, right. So we just got a cheap rental canoe that was perfect.
Yeah.
It was nice to get out of the pack rafts for a little while and have all that space, and then paddled to Dawson.
And then you, from Dawson, you hiked over to the Mackenzie River and floated out the Mackenzie with your pack rafts. And there are multiple stories within this book that are real, you know, epics, right? And getting out the Mackenzie River Delta sounds like one of them.
Yeah, so we had this sort of logistical challenge because we wanted to get from, you know, the Coast Mountains over to the Wind River, which is the site of that trip I mentioned earlier with the bark canoe, in part just because it was such a memorable experience and we were excited to revisit that region. So we wanted to get from, you know, there to the Wind River and then out to the Arctic coast. And in some ways on paper, it looked very logical. The Mackenzie River flows, you know, north to the Arctic and takes us out to the Arctic coast where we want to go. And so it seemed like, you know, obviously that's the way we should go. And we'd certainly heard stories from other travelers about the Mackenzie River being slow and buggy and whatever else. But I don't think we had anticipated just how bad could be until we got on the Mackenzie River. It was, yeah, the mosquitoes were unlike any place I've ever seen in my life. The flat water pack rafting, as many listeners may know, is not where the pack rafts excel. Pack rafts are amazing crafts that allow you to get to, you know, places that otherwise wouldn't be possible. And they're a really ideal way to travel through Alaska where there aren't a lot of roads and bridges and easy access points. But they don't do great on flat water, especially not with a headwind, because they're these little inflatable rubber rafts and the wind pushes against them pretty good. So we had really strong headwinds coming from the north, pushing us backwards. And then it turned out that near the mouth of the delta, the channels flow in all these smaller sloughs and narrower channels. And some of them, because of the winds coming from the north, actually pushed the water backwards. So we were paddling against the wind and against the current, even though the overall flow of the river is to the north. And the mosquitoes were, you know, beyond bad to the point that we stopped cooking dinners because we were using fire almost exclusively throughout all the Arctic. And so it was just too much to think about getting out and making a fire in those bugs to be worth actually eating dinner. We would just snack on whatever we had or have cold, rehydrated instant oatmeal or coffee with cold Mackenzie sludge water. Got to the point where at one point I was in the tent and I had a yogurt container that I used for my belt bucket and my food dish. And I was like, well, I can either pee in my food dish or I can go outside in the mosquitoes. And the decision was an obvious one to me at the time. So yeah, it was that was the lowest point in the journey for sure. Especially psychologically, it was the first time I think that we had both really questioned what we were doing and why we were doing this. It seemed quite pointless and miserable on top of it.
I was just going to use the word
fortunately. Go ahead.
I was just going to use the word miserable, hellish, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's just sounded really miserable. Yeah. But you kept going.
Yeah, in part because we had no other choice. You know, one sort of blessing and reality of taking these wilderness trips is that usually you get yourself in, and the only way to get out is to get yourself out unless you call for a rescue, which we certainly, you know, that wasn't an option at that point. So we kind of had to keep going. And fortunately, the reward was well worth it.
So, again, this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, on Alaska Public Media. I'm with Caroline Van Humer, who has a new book, The Sun is a Compass, tells the story of her and her husband's trip from Bellingham to Kotzebue. So, Caroline, we're out on the Arctic Ocean now. You make your way by pack raft and foot. We're not going to tell all the stories because people should read the book, and you have some book talks coming up also. But you had a near miss in a stormy landing on the Arctic Ocean. But you've made it to Herschel Island, where you got another resupply, and then started your hiking portion. And you then, how long did it take from there to paddle and hike over to the headwaters of the Noatak River?
That's a good question. We got to Herschel Island, it was early July, and then we got to the headwaters of the Noatak at the end of August, so about 8 weeks, I guess. Yeah, and so we, for the most part, we were, you know, along the Arctic coast, we were hiking and pack rafting, kind of mixing up the mode of transport depending on the conditions and the terrain. And then we did the same thing to Arctic Village. And from there, we mailed our pack rafts to Anaktuvik Pass because we were trying to go as light as possible. And for the most part, there was one big river crossing we had to do. But beyond that, we could essentially stay on the crest of the Brooks Range and avoid having to cross a lot of big water bodies, and without the pack rafts, we were quite a bit lighter. So we did mail them. The big challenge we had, which was actually the opening of the book, is we crossed the Chandelier River, and we had decided to swim that instead of having our boats because it allowed us to travel much more quickly through the rest of the Brooks Range. And, you know, at first glance, it might seem like a really dumb decision, and we certainly questioned it at times. But, you know, sometimes being light is actually the safest thing for backcountry travel, especially the way that we were doing it, which was, you know, fairly large distances between resupplies because we were relying almost exclusively on the postal service to pick up resupplies as opposed to air support, which has its own challenges. So we had to swim the Chandelier River, which turned out to be a lot bigger and scarier than we had initially anticipated.
Right, and you made it through that. I think the other fascinating thing about this story for me is the people you met along the way, and the realization that, you know, people have been traveling and living in this land for thousands of years, and sort of managing what you do as part what you did as part of their daily life. I thought that was super interesting. Talk a little bit about some of the people you met and how they helped you and how they added to the trip.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, for being in mostly by ourselves for those 6 months, I think our human encounters were at least as meaningful as our wildlife encounters. And we definitely got a lot of great advice and insights from local knowledge. I think there's nothing that can replace that. And that's one of the challenges in trying to plan a trip in advance is that, you know, the people you most need to talk to aren't necessarily the ones you're going to find on social media or even, you know, easily by email. But we were fortunate when we came to communities, for the most part, people were very welcoming and really interested in talking about kind of their maps of the land that, you know, they had seen themselves and certainly their families over generations had experienced. It took me a little while at first to figure out how to answer questions, because people would say, you know, they'd ask, oh, where are you coming from? That was kind of the most common question we got. And we started off by saying, well, we started in Washington. And then I'd say, well, I'm, you know, we are from Anchorage and from Haines. And I just get these blank stares kind of consistently. And then I realized that people were not interested in hearing, you know, about these places that were so far from their own experiences. They wanted to hear about where we had been on their maps, which meant like, you know, the John River or the Little Moose Slough or whatever area we had been in recently. And then that was kind of what opened up conversation, because those were experiences they could relate to and they had a lot to share. We were really fortunate to meet some amazing people along the way who helped us in, you know, all sorts of different ways, whether it was by, you know, inviting us in for caribou soup or for, you know, telling us what areas to avoid or what routes, you know, they recommended for river travel or hiking or whatever. So, yeah, it was certainly a really important part of our trip.
Oh, yeah, that local knowledge is key. Tell us a little bit more about some of your wildlife encounters. What were some of the highlights, maybe a story or two about something that really stands out with the wildlife that you saw?
Yeah, I think probably the most, I love all the bird encounters I had along the way, of course, as a bird biologist. And the migration was a really special time, as I mentioned, in the spring. But then I think the one moment that was sort of the culmination of so much that we'd experienced on the trip was we were coming down the Noatak River, and we had just had, in the sort of week or two preceding that, we'd had an encounter with a predatory black bear that was absolutely terrifying and kind of left us both feeling like afraid of bears for the first time in, you know, 5 months in the backcountry and many years in Alaska's wilderness. And it really shook my confidence and eventually sort of came out of that. But anyway, that was, we were dealing with a predatory black bear, and then we had early snow in the Berks Range that meant that we weren't able to travel over this pass that we had intended and had to go this much longer route, and ended up being, you know, somewhat epic in its own right. And then we finally got to the Noatak River, and that was the one location where we had an airdrop planned. And because of all this stormy weather, it was, you know, record flooding in a lot of those areas. The plane wasn't able to get to us. And so we sat there for about 5 days with no food and, we weren't to the point of starving, like certainly some people have experienced, but it felt like we were pushing our limits, especially because we had been pretty low on food for the week and a half preceding that. So we're coming off of all of this. We had finally gotten a food resupply and made it onto the river. And then we had an encounter with caribou crossing the Noatak River, and we were able to essentially be sort of enfolded in their migration for several hours, and it was a really magical experience. We'd been following caribou trails for many months over the mountains. It sort of guided us through terrain that seemed more or less impenetrable, and then finally, it wasn't the same caribou, but to have the experience of seeing caribou on their migration was really amazing. There were thousands and thousands of animals that passed us, sometimes literally inches from our faces. So that was probably the biggest highlight in terms of wildlife.
Great. This is Outdoor Explorer, the Paul Twardock. And I have Carolyn Van Humert with me, a research biologist at USGS, talking about her new book, The Sun is a Compass. So, Caroline, we talked about the caribou crossing. You talk about your experience with the birds. When you think, and you saw muskox, we're on the Noatak River now, we're headed down you finally got your resupply, which was a very fascinating part of the story, having run out of food out in the wilderness. It's not a lot of fun, and especially not knowing when the plane's going to show up, but you had that moment, the plane finally made it in, you had your food, and you're on your way. You have this amazing experience with caribou. You saw muskox, you saw wolves, you saw bears, you had a scary experience with a bear. You're seeing these birds at the northern weed eater who migrates to Africa, all these amazing things. Did you you're a scientist, and so you're used to studying somewhat, hopefully, or theoretically, dispassionately about your subject matter. Did you have a feeling of a different feeling as a scientist? Did the trip change your way of operating as a scientist? Meaning, did you start to see animals in a different nature? Does that sort of make sense, that question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I'm pretty good at putting on my scientist hat when I need to. But I think I was at a point in my career and personally where I needed to take that scientist hat off for a little while and kind of remind myself of what had drawn me to biology in the first place. And so this was a good opportunity. You know, of course, I see a bird and I don't just think, oh, that's a beautiful bird. I think about it as a scientist as well. And I'm interested in, you know, where it came from and what its habits are in terms of what it eats and where it builds its nest. And so I'm always thinking in those terms. But I think having the luxury for a period of time to just be able to observe and not have to be studying something was a real gift. And that was a really important part of that journey for me. And also an important part of kind of returning to science. Not that I ever left it for too long, but, you know, I had questioned like, where is this taking me and what do I want in all of this? So yeah, I think as far as like performing as a scientist, I would say that it didn't really change the way that I do my work, but it did kind of reconnect me to why I do my work in the first place. And yeah, as much as maybe anyone, I do like having the opportunity to walk away from my desk and the statistics and the models and just be able to appreciate the fact that a bird is a really amazing critter. And there's so many fun things about watching it for the sake of watching it.
That's great. Now, one of the topics that you talk a lot about is family and what I think about kids. And my understanding now that you have two young boys, correct?
That's right. Yep, 2 and 4.
And it's not too much of a spoiler because in the book you have a picture of your son. And I'm curious about how they've having them have changed your relationship with wilderness. And particularly, I'd like to interest you. You have this term called micro views that you talk about a trip that you took your 10-week-old son, is that correct, on a trip on the Lost Coast, which is a stretch of beach between sort of between Southeast Alaska and Prince William Sound. So talk a little bit about how that's changed your and your husband's view and a relationship with wilderness and nature.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, that was kind of one of the biggest fears and worries I had about the prospect of having kids is, you know, would we have to stop doing what we loved so much? And what had actually become really fundamental to our own relationship, our marriage, is, you know, being out in these amazing wild places. And, you know, I guess that the short answer is it has changed it, but I don't think it's all been, you know, by any means for the worse. We've had the opportunity to kind of recalibrate and figure out, you know, what adventure looks like for us as a family. And Pat and I still have opportunities to go and do, you know, independent trips either together if we, you know, rely on grandparents or friends, but more often separately now. But what we've ended up doing a lot more of is trips as a family. And yeah, you mentioned that first trip we took on the Lost Coast with Huxley, our older son, and he was very small. And there are definitely moments of being out there and thinking like, what a tiny baby in the middle of the wilderness, but then like a foreign place to me. I mean, there are certainly other challenges that are posed there, but I think there's a certain amount of risk in just, you know, being alive. So we've been able to sort of take our philosophy, I guess, about being out in the wilderness and have our children join us. And this year we've been really fortunate to take a sabbatical of sorts. And we spent last summer sailing up the Inside Passage from Bellingham to Haines. So very similar to the trip we did in our rowboats, but with our kids. And we took our time. We were much slower than we were when we were rowing. And those micro views that you mentioned become so essential. And I think that's one of the gifts that children offer us is that they are constantly focused on the micro views. They're not looking for, you know, how many miles from here are they going to get to see some cool thing. It's the cool things at their feet in front of them, you know, whether it's a mussel shell or a sea anemone that they didn't realize squirted at them when they touched it or all sorts of things. So we were, so it's been a real gift to kind of have those views to refresh our perspective on wilderness as well. And I think by no means does, you know, having a family mean you have to stop adventuring, but it does mean that you got to recalibrate so that it's not just about the adult experience. It's about everyone's experience.
That's fantastic. Well, Caroline, thanks for being on the show. You have a book release event coming up here in South Central Alaska. You have on March 20th a talk at the Anchorage Museum at 7 p.m. March 21st, you have a talk at Fireside Books. And March 25th at the UAA Bookstore at 4 p.m. And then this show will air right after the Anchorage Museum show, but right before the Palmer and UAA book talks. So looking forward to those. I guess my last question for you, I started with the end of the trip. I'm going to finish with the beginning. So Pat broke his tooth the day before you left. Is that right?
That's right.
And so did he just go the whole trip with a broken tooth? Is that, I'm like, wow.
He did, yeah. It didn't seem to cause him too much trouble. He said he would chew on the other side of his mouth when he had something hard. But, that's kind of Pat's approach to life is if it isn't quite as you expected, then figure it out and work around it.
Well, that's amazing. So thank you very much for being on the show. If people want to learn more about doing 4,000 or 5,000 miles with a broken tooth and lots of adventure and seeing a lot of Alaska. That's an impressive thing for me that you both saw a tremendous amount of Alaska over 6 months. Look up Caroline's book, and a lot of her information will be on the Outdoor Explorer website about her different talks and the book itself. Thank you very much, Caroline, for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to the second part of Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. And this is Alaska Public Media, KSKA 91.1. My next guest in the studio is Dr. Kathy Kulitz. She works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the Division of Migratory Bird Management. Kathy's been in Alaska since 1974, has been working and studying seabirds since 1978, and she started in Prince William Sound. This show is airing right before the 30th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and I thought it'd be interesting to check in with one of the experts on how the sound is doing. So welcome to the studio, Kathy.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
Let's get right to the chase. How are seabirds doing in the North Gulf and in Prince William Sound?
Well, in general, they're not doing well. This last few years, as you probably heard, we had the blob, we've had a heat wave. In the ocean, basically, since 2015, seabirds throughout the Gulf, at least at colonies that have been studied and in Prince William Sound, they've been doing poorly. That's mainly at certain select colonies where we monitor them, other people monitor them, USGS and Fish and Wildlife Service, and either birds didn't show up or they did not reproduce. So it's looking bad for birds in that sense. And after several years, you know, at first you're not sure if the birds are really declining in population. They could just not breed and they're off in the water somewhere. But after several years, it's looking like there actually has been some decline in populations of some species, at least.
Yeah, it's such a huge area and large area. How do you go about studying them?
Well, there's a lot of what I do right now. I used to do colony work in Prince William Sound, but a lot of what I do right now is count birds from ships or put other people out on ships, and we do bird surveys in conjunction with other ecological research going on offshore. That's supported by North Pacific Research Board and BOEM, and it's in conjunction with a lot of NOAA's work offshore. So that's one way to count birds at sea. At the colony, that's mostly done by the Alaska Maritime Refuge. It's a national wildlife refuge that operates all over Alaska. So they have select colonies that they monitor. They send people out there to either stay on the islands and count birds and see how many eggs they lay, how many chicks hatch, and how many chicks are actually fledged. Sometimes they just drive by quick counts. Sometimes USGS has funding to study colonies. They're working now up in Upper Cook Inlet. But mostly the Maritime Refuge has been monitoring.
All right, great. And so let's go back to the oil spill. It's been 30 years since the oil spill. You were studying birds out in the sound. Mm-hmm. I believe murrelets and common murres and black-legged guillemots. Is that right?
Well, it's red-legged kitty.
Oh, red-legged.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're getting me confused now. It's black-legged kittiwakes,
right,
which are common in the sound.
Yeah.
I was actually first studying pigeon guillemots.
All right.
There's not a lot of common guillemots in the sound except in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I started with, the guillemots. It was my first bird study out there at Naked Island in central Prince William Sound. And that was in 1978. So at that time, they basically dumped two of us off, myself and Karen Oakley, who's now retired. But that was when the Valdez pipeline was coming down there, and they wanted us to do a baseline study to see what was out there. They basically said, go around the islands. There's a cluster of islands out there near Naked Island, and count the birds and see what's out there and see what you can find out about them.
That's amazing. So they gave you a boat and said,
they dumped us off.
See you in September?
Basically, it was early May back then, full deep snow at that time.
Uh-huh.
Two women off on this island, and it was pretty amazing. They dumped us off with a lot of gear and said, here's how you start the outboard motor, and
yeah,
we'll see you in end of August.
And so how did things change? Like from there, let's try to, I know as a scientist, it's hard to eliminate variables, including climate change. But let's focus on the time of the oil spill and what happened to birds during that time. I know a lot of people are very focused on bald eagles, but or maybe the black-legged kittiwake, the sort of the flashy birds. So if we look at different species, what happened to them during the spill and then immediately after the spill?
Well, during the spill, it was, of course, a massive direct mortality. This happened in late March, so it was a changeover period when birds that overwinter in Prince William Sound, so a different group of birds, sea ducks and such, and murres, are maybe still in the sound, but they're also leaving, and breeding birds are just starting to come in. A lot of the mortality happened as you leave Prince William Sound, as the oil flowed out of Prince William Sound and down the Alaska Peninsula, past Kodiak and all that. So the mortality was huge, of course, estimated to be somewhere around 250,000 birds, 300,000 birds.
Wow.
Mostly diving birds like murres and murrelets, which were on the water, a lot.
Right. And did they... So we had the event itself. Then did the populations come back? What occurred in the following 10 years or 20 years?
Well, of course, there was a massive effort to do damage assessment, try to get an estimate of what happened. And mm-hmm. one of the first things that Fish and Wildlife realized was that there was very little baseline data for 17 years. We had done, but other people before me had done a survey back in 1973, in Prince William Sound, using small boat surveys to assess the population of Prince William Sound. And so they had population estimates from 1973, and then the next time was 1989 after the oil spill. And a lot had happened since then. There had been more fisheries. There had been an increase in hatchery-released fish. A lot had gone on, yeah. So it was an eye-opener, I think, for a lot of people, how important it is to keep long-term monitoring going.
Mm-hmm.
Because when these events happen, you have to have something to hang your hat on, and that there wasn't a lot there in some cases. So everyone went out to different places and monitored the colonies. And the thing with seabirds is that if you're looking at colonial birds, you can go to the colony and get a good index of who's breeding, how many, how they're doing. But if they're disrupted, like during the oil spill or during this recent heat wave, they may not show up at the colony, but the birds are still out there. They're alive. They're just foraging elsewhere, not bothering to breed. And then they've come back gradually. And it can take a few years before you tell if there's really been a population-level impact.
Mm-hmm.
So that was going on. Immediately, it seemed like birds certainly were disrupted. There was disruption in their foraging areas and their breeding areas, besides mortality, direct mortality. Birds like the pigeon guillemot, which tends to hang out near the rocks, intertidal rocks, they hang out by their colonies down by the rocks, and so they're exposed to all the oil that came under the rocks. They are one of the birds that was severely injured and are still considered injured over the long term. You have other birds like marble murrelets, which I wound up studying for my PhD later, that are not colonial. They're all over the sound. They were very abundant, but they had have decreased now to about 10% of what the estimates were in 73. So, there's been big changes going on, and it was really hard to say what was the oil spill and what other factors might have been happening because warming temperatures, the regime shifts, et cetera. But certainly there are, you can detect blips in populations from the oil spill.
Would it be safe to say that those species that were healthy before the spill had a better chance of recovery and have done better since the oil spill than those species that were possibly declining pre-spill?
That would be hard to say because I'm trying to think of one that we had identified as possibly declining before the spill.
Yeah.
I don't think there were good enough studies really to indicate that.
Okay. So, as far as the species are out there, have any recovered really since the spill?
In terms of numbers to pre-spill levels, bald eagles, but that's not as
it. Well, that's one that a lot of people see.
Perhaps some gulls. I can't think of any where the numbers are now up around pre-spill levels.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, Alaska Public Media. In the studio, I have Dr. Kathy Kulitz. We're talking about the birds in the North Gulf and Prince William Sound since the oil spill, as we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the oil spill. Kathy, I would assume, I asked a question about populations pre and post, but so now let's talk about what's going on. You started talking about how things are declining. The blob, which if listeners haven't heard about that, was a large warm water mass in the North Gulf that is come
North
back.
Pacific,
North Pacific, North Pacific. Is that it seems to have gone away? Has it come back? What do we know about the blob with this last year?
Well, it's not being necessarily called the blob anymore, but it's but that's what they identify as that first big blob. It was a big, unusually warm water mass that came up from basically off coast of California, moved up the coast and hung around into the area, the entire North Pacific, but also hit the northern Gulf of Alaska. And so that we have since then had similar each year, another unusually anomalous mm-hmm. hot water event happening in the northern Gulf of Alaska, throughout the Gulf of Alaska, really. And so, although it's not called necessarily the blob anymore, it's definitely happening still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that seems to, we know that affects the food source, whether it's zooplankton or fish. And there's evidence of repercussions and cascade effects all the way up the food chain.
So a few years ago, we had a massive die-off of common murres, and that was that starvation? Did we ever figure out what that was?
Right. Well, a lot of people collected the birds, and we sent them to the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin, and other people looked at them here in town through USGS lab, and certainly there were they all starved. I mean, they were all emaciated. It's possible there were harmful algae problems, toxins, saxitoxin and such that they impacted their foraging, but it's really hard to pick that up in birds. So you're not going to get a positive test necessarily. They metabolize so fast, birds do, that it's not present in their system by the time you find them dead. And more recent studies have found that even healthy appearing birds might have some level of that in their system. But there is some, it's possible that was one factor, but certainly the biggest suspect is simply lack of food. It's possible, again, that some of the food, like small fish, might have moved offshore with the warm water or in deeper waters. But the birds that were really affected, like common murres, they're very deep divers. They can go, 200 meters there.
Wow.
They should be able to get to the fish.
Yeah, wow. Huh. When we talk about what's going on now and even looking in the future, what unusual things have you seen in the North Gulf and in Prince William Sound? Mm-hmm. Are new species moving in? Are species trying to adapt by moving to the warmer water? Any ideas with that?
We've certainly seen some of that. We've had some unusual sightings in our offshore surveys. More albatross have been showing up from Hawaiian islands, black-footed albatross and lay sand albatross. But that's in the outer Gulf, not in Prince William Sound, of course. But so a few other species, weird shearwaters and stuff like that. But in terms of what we know from long-term observations, for instance, kittiwakes in the Sound, Dave Irons, a colleague who's been worked there for 40 years, has been monitoring some 20-some colonies, 22 colonies or something, of kittiwakes in the Sound every year. And it's really been unprecedented to have 3 years in a row where even black-legged kittiwakes do not nest or were totally unsuccessful. And that's what he's found the last few years. And they're finding that in colonies in Lower Cook Inlet and at the Barren Islands. So that's very unusual. Common MERS and kittiwakes for those both to fail. Kittiwakes have up and down years, and their surface feeders are the more susceptible to changes that might affect surface fish and stuff. But the MERS, they've always been the steady pump out 0.5 chicks that you heard every colony. So that was an eye-opener, that something big is happening across the system.
Yeah.
Although there are some colonies further out the Gulf towards the Chowweet, Chiswells, they're doing okay.
Okay, interesting.
Now,
interesting. And what, like looking in the future, if you had a crystal ball, with climate change and changes in use and so forth, any ideas what we might see? Like new species or like our we can talk about sort of the negative. It's like, oh, populations are decreasing.
Right.
You know, how?
Looking for positive.
Yeah,
things.
Well, not just positive, but change. Like, well, how else are things going to change?
Yeah. Most of the new species accounts or range increases that I've heard about or seen ourselves in our surveys has happened in the Bering Sea and in the Arctic, more southerly species moving north and even starting to breed up further north. In the Gulf, I'm not aware of any new species of seabirds taking hold there necessarily. I have to mention, of course, Skitlitz's murrets, which nest up in the high mountains, and they have foraged near glacier fronts and stuff in the tidewater glacier areas. They've been heavily impacted by changes, I think, in glaciers.
Yeah.
And the loss of that habitat. I expect that they could disappear further as the glaciers retreat. There are some strongholds, you know, down in Icy Bay and outer Prince William Sound there. That's probably the one kittiwake colony, I guess, that did well. And then you can still find kittiwakes hanging out there on a regular basis. So that's an example. There might be little reservoirs, little refuges where they can hang out. I can't think right now of any. I'm not aware of any species. I can't imagine any coming up to colonies. Perhaps there's, you know, the tufted puffins are having a hard time throughout the North Pacific. There's evidence they have been declining in some areas in Alaska as well, and they're petitioning to list the species. In the lower 48 anyway, California, Oregon, Washington.
Yeah.
But up here, perhaps there'll be a refuge there.
Yeah. Well, and I imagine a lesson we have not to forget is that the oil spill had a dramatic effect on species, a big mortality event. And with the challenges that these species are getting from climate change, we really have to be diligent not to have another spill, another big event like that could be very, very devastating for some of these species.
Yeah, they're getting hit multiple directions.
Well, thank you very much for being in the studio with me today. I have Dr. Kathy Hulitz with me, so thank you for joining us.
You bet.
This has been Outdoor Explorer. Thanks to my guests, Carolyn Van Humert and Kathy Hulitz. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer on 91.1 KSKA in Alaska Public Media. Our producer is Eric Bork, and I'm your host, Paul Tordock. We'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.